This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam ala Rasulullah, wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. So, whose first time is it here? Anybody's? It's your first time?
Yeah.
Oh, great. MashaAllah. What we had been doing for the last month or so was just kind of going through the different mechanics to the prayer. And what I was thinking we would do over the course of the summer is a deeper dive into prayer itself. Talking about outward and inward aspects of it, but the various terms that are utilized. I think a lot of us in the room are not native Arabic speakers, and even if you are, Quranic Arabic isn't necessarily the same as spoken Arabic in various dialects. So there's a little bit of nuance that gets lost. So spending a good chunk of time just going through the words and what they mean, you know, to kind of not lose nuance on it. How does that sound? Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah.
How has it been for those who were here the last few weeks? Has anyone been able to like try to implement any of what we were discussing? Kind of as you're practicing or building relationship just with the mechanics of prayer? Yeah.
When I've been doing prayer, it's really been what my upbringing has taught me.
Yeah.
So I've been able to take like your lectures and that, and make sure that the way I'm acting the prayers are really correct.
Great. You guys are late. Oh man. You're a school teacher and you're late to class.
Yeah, some old friend.
That's,
you know,
crazy. I should make you sit in the corner. And no, no worries. Anyone else? Sorry, did anyone else have their hand raised? We're just asking if there's been like implementation of things that we talked about over the last few weeks and how that's been in terms of just kind of building a relationship to the mechanics of the prayer itself. Yeah.
I found it very helpful because I think I told you like I wasn't raised in this religion at all, and so I was like following a YouTube video. And there's like just certain things you can't pick up on from that, and so like when we're talking about like really the specifics of like posture and like different positions, that was very helpful because it's not something you can quite get from the video.
Great, glad to hear that. Okay. Any other thoughts before we start getting into some things today? So, why don't we take a quick minute? I know everyone doesn't know everyone else. And I also just have to get used to being in this room and kind of the shift in the vibe of the space. So if you just take a quick minute, introduce yourselves to the people sitting around you. If you already know the person right next to you, maybe the person behind you, in front of you, and then we'll get started in just a minute. But go ahead.
Okay, should we get started?
So we're gonna do a deeper dive into what is a particular form of prayer in Islam that is called Salah. You might also see it, people will call it Salat. These are in reference to five daily prayers that Muslims have. Some of what we're going to talk about will rehash over the course of the coming months what we've talked about in terms of mechanics in the last few weeks. A lot of it will be kind of juxtaposed to other information as well. I think likely what we're going to do is try to start, we're promptly at 6, and that's my fault, I apologize. I just got tied up in a couple of things beforehand, and we're also just trying to tell people that we're at the end of the hall, that we're in a different room. We're going to be in this room through mid-August. So just people want to keep that in mind. Dr. Marwa, who is one of our staff psychologists, she's not here today. If you can keep her in your prayers, her mother is feeling sick. So she is at home with her mom. But she typically will be doing a class concurrently in the prayer room. That was like the time she was doing regularly. The building closes at 8 now in the summer. That's why we moved this up to 6 o'clock. We'll aim to end between like 7:15 and 7:30, so that for those of you who are going to be in need of praying the fourth prayer of the day, Maghrib, at sunset, you'll be able to get to a place with enough time to actually pray it, because the building will be closed here. We won't be able to do that here. Does that make sense? Likely between like 6 and 7:30 is the time frame that we'll be kind of doing this. And what I'd like to do is utilize kind of a combination of structures to the class, but the more generic form of it would be in talking about outward elements of the prayer, mechanics, the do's and don'ts, these kinds of things. And then for a chunk of the class, talking about like the inward aspects of it, right? Which is a big part of the prayer in Islam. We're not just praying with our bodies, but we're praying with our hearts, right? We're not just praying, but we're praying to God. That's kind of the fundamental idea of prayer in Islam. The way Arabic functions as a language is that words have root letters to them. Does anybody here have any familiarity with Arabic as a language? Just so we know, a little bit. You do, a little? Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah, great. So, for example, the name of the religion that we're discussing is Islam. Someone who practices Islam is called a Muslim. And you've likely heard other words that have these letters, like salam, for example. Or somebody might say assalamu alaikum to you when they're greeting you, right? But you see a link where there are these letters in each of these words. Salama. In Arabic, it's a sin, a lam, and a mim. And you can see the link between the words. Does that make sense? Right, there's an etymology there that is important to understand. And the way Arabic functions as a language, which is not an Arabic class, but we want to understand the nuance of certain things through kind of the base meanings of these words. The way that Arabic functions as a language is that most words have three letter root systems. On occasion, you might have a word that has two letters or four letters, but predominantly all of the words, for the most part, have a three letter root system. Does that make sense? Right, like my name is Khalid in Arabic. The root of that is Khalada, right? And then the way that the words are built out, there's like forms. So you have kind of the letters placed into the forms, and they then denote meaning through the form that the letters are taking. Yeah. So in this word that we're going to be looking at in terms of prayer, like particularly the salah, the daily ritual prayers, the base root letters of these are a waw, a sad, and a lam, wasala. And you could also find it in an Arabic dictionary where it would be under Sad, Lam, Waw. So this is a Waw, a Sad, and a Lam, right? Wasala or Sad, Lam, Waw. You don't have to know the letters. That's not like the point of it. But this root of Wasala, in Arabic, it denotes like to be linked to something or to be connected to something. There's like a union that's taking place there, right? And that idea of that link is imperative to understand, because that's the basis of this, right? There's so much that goes into understanding things through the names of things, the meanings of things. So when somebody says to you, Salah is just daily prayer, like that's gonna have a connotation to you through language that you have familiarity with, and it's got whatever kind of imagery it's going to evoke. But what the Arabic is seeking to evoke is that this thing is a link between you and God, Like, that's what it's doing. It's literally linking, it's connecting you to the divine in these moments that you're engaged in. So where we would have kind of, here's me, this is a prayer, and then what it's connecting me to is God. Like a literal linkage in the sense of, I'm not standing in prayer, I'm standing in prayer to Allah. You see the nuance difference? And that linkage is something that's important to understand, right? It's a point of connection. It's a point of building off of a foundational theology in Islam that the salah in and of itself is an act of worship, but it demonstrates fundamentally what the role is of the worshiper to the one being worshipped. So if you think about it in terms of things that we discussed in our prayer classes in the last few weeks, for those of you who are here, do you have a question? Are you raising your hand? No? You can, it's okay. Like when I'm going into prayer, I'm in a place now where fundamentally everything that I have going on, can I erase this stuff?
I'm erasing it.
The actions, the recitations, like everything that's going on there is meant to give us at a more microcosmic level an understanding that I'm not the one that's in charge of everything. Right? If you remember when we talked about the conditions of prayer, the obligations of prayer, one of the things that we discussed was called the tahrima. This is like that initial Allahu Akbar, thanks man, that you would say to enter into the prayer, right? If you guys remember, we said you could say like Subhanallah or Alhamdulillah in the obligation category, but the necessary, the wajib, is to say Allahu Akbar. What this means, tahrima, the same idea. You look at the root letters, its basis is harama, which you get words like haram from, for example. The idea is that when you're doing this tahrima, similar to when people go on pilgrimage to Mecca, and you've ever seen people dressed in their clothes, they're in a state that's called ihram. And it's a state where what's permissible is now made to be impermissible. So like when you're in your salah and you're connected to God, everything else stops. That's the idea. Like that link is something that there's not anything else that you would be doing, that you could normally be doing. So in your salah, it's just you connected to the divine. You're not picking up a phone when it rings. You can normally pick up your phone. You can pick up your phone right now. But in your prayer, you have now entered into this through this invocation that's saying certain acts, mundane or otherwise, they're not going to happen as I'm engaged in the course of this prayer. I can't watch TV while I'm in a prayer. I'm not in a place even where it's about doing things that I could do stationary, but my movements, the way my arms go, my legs go, everything, where my eyes are looking. I'm not turning my head around in circles. I'm in a place where everything, according to Islamic practice, in the course of this particular type of prayer that we're talking about, salah, you're just doing it the way that you've been told to do it. There's not room to say, maybe I'm gonna do this today in, like, you know, a wife beater and like a pair of short shorts, right? No, it's an act of obedience that also is instilling within its practitioner a notion that says it's done the way that you're taught to do it. You do it at the times that you're taught to do it. You're in a place where the direction that you face is even identified. The placement of your hands, the positioning of your fingers, all of this thing is deeply outlined in this because it's giving now through the idea of it being a connection to God, the fundamental understanding in Islam that you're the one that is worshiping God and you're in a state of subservience to God, and it's not the other way around. So whatever else is going on in that moment, barring like emergency situations, right? If you're in a place of prayer and something's going on crazy around you, like you break your prayer, you don't just keep kind of praying. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense? Like I was telling somebody earlier today, I was in a Zoom meeting and I live in an NYU building. Some of you have been to our place before in our building, right? And I don't know, it was like for any of you who are in college or you went to college at some point, or even in high school, you had fire drills and stuff. So we live in a dorm building. There's all kinds of kids. They have no idea how to cook stuff. And they'll like burn things in their microwave, the fire alarm goes off, or there's drills. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, after a bunch of people started moving out of the building, and we're in New York, and you can imagine 1,000 kids moved out of the building, you know, over the course of a week, garbage bags are piled crazy high, and somebody lit the garbage bags on fire, you know? And we're in a place where we live on the third floor and smoke is coming in and, you know, you could see like the flames. It's crazy like how high they were going. And everyone's evacuating and then they're telling us to go back in because the fire is outside of the building, not inside of the building. And it's 2 a.m. I have no idea what's going on. My wife Priya comes and she shakes me and she's like, the building's on fire. I'm like, no, it's not, go to sleep. She's like, no, like there's smoke everywhere. And I'm like, oh, it'll be fine, right? Because that was a fire drill. If you are praying in the midst of that, you break your prayer. Do you understand, right? That's not the same as, hey, like I forgot to turn the stove off. Or, you know, my friend just sent me a text message. Do you see the difference? Within it, the link is to God, and there's not an absolute severing, but the links to everything else, they just stop at that moment. You're putting aside anything else that you're connected to, and for 5 times in a day, you're revisiting the idea that you are in a place where you are creation and there's a creator that you are engaging. And you're seeking to build a connection through this practice to that creator. Does that make sense? So somebody says to you, Muslims pray 5 times a day. Really what they're saying is 5 times a day, Muslims strive to build a connection to their God, right? And it just sounds different. It doesn't sound the same, you know? Because when you think of prayer, there's so many different things that can come up, right? People can have a certain sense of longing in prayer, right? Some people conceptualize prayer the way that you make a wish on a birthday cake. That's what prayer is. You know, I'm just asking for things. Do you know what I mean? Right? That's not what the point is in Islam with this type of prayer. The point of it is embedded in the meaning of the word. The idea is that it is not only a way, but the best way to be connected to God. Does that make sense? Yeah? So what comes in the Quran is over and over again, there's like, you know, almost, there's less than 100, but probably like 70 to 80 different times this word is mentioned in the Quran in various ways. But the same way when we talked about wudu and we looked at the verse in the Quran that had the parts of the body that we said were the obligatory parts to wash in your wudu. Do people remember what I'm talking about, right? And it says in that verse, "Faghsilu," that you wash yourself. You know, it's in an imperative and it talks about then washing your face and the arms and wiping over the head and washing the feet, right? Is it, remember? You remember it?
Yeah, I would say it was 4 weeks.
There you go. It was 4 weeks of talking about washing your feet. You better remember it. That's right. And so what you find in the Quran, in a lot of places, is also an imperative around prayer, but it doesn't say, like, pray. It says establish prayer. And so it'll be in the Arabic something like aqim as-salah. It'll say iqam as-salah. Something like that, right? And so when we have, for example, the call to prayer in Islam, for our salah is called the adhan, right? You might have heard it. Somebody gets up, says Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, till the end of like the series of statements. And they're telling people literally come to prayer, right? And then when everybody is praying in congregation, they do what's called the iqamah. It's about establishing the prayer and getting to a place where we can now understand, well, what does this mean, right? What does it sound like to you when someone says establish prayer in your life? What I want you to do is just turn to the person next to you, because you're going to read translations, right? You're going to hear people say this, like establish the prayer. What does that sound like when you have that terminology? Like, what is it evoking within you? If you can just discuss for a couple of minutes with the person sitting next to you, and then you can come back and talk it out. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, so what does it sound like? Somebody says establish prayer, you know, in English, in whatever language you speak. Like, how would you take that? What do you think it's telling or instructing one to do? Yeah, go ahead.
The discussion we're having, Sam brought up a good point of having the intention of establishing a connection with God 5 times a day and then making salah.
Great. Having the intention, establishing 5 times a day connection with God. Other things? Yeah.
Yeah, just building on that, I was thinking, like, you can go to a space, any space, whatever, but if you're going to an establishment, like, there's intention behind that space. So that was kind of the link to, and also we're always talking about intention.
Yeah, intention, great. And how does it link to establishment? Like, you just said you're going to an establishment, so just, like, think about that a little bit. Yeah, go ahead.
It hit different for me, like, saying praying versus established prayer. And it's similar to what was said over here, almost like setting a foundation or creating circumstances that are conducive to prayer. I thought of like establishing a healthy eating routine or establishing a gym routine. Yeah, so it becomes normal in your life.
And what is that like when you establish healthy, if you flesh it out more?
You maybe choose to stop going out drinking as much or these sorts of things. As was said here, you pick a setting that's conducive to prayer. You put yourself in energetic space that's conducive to prayer, a certain mindset. So that's what I thought of, like a holistic approach.
Great.
And just to piggyback on what you said, like when you're creating a gym routine, something that you want to like, you know, want to create a routine for your prayer and like find some value in it to your personal life. So I think that's pretty much what I boiled down to.
Any other thoughts? Yeah, so in the establishing of prayer, like who's doing the establishing? Huh?
Ourselves?
Yeah, right? You are, I am. The prayer is not establishing itself. Like you're establishing the prayer, right? The same way Sam says you go to an establishment. What does that like literally mean? The foundation of something had to be created in order for some kind of edifice to now literally exist in this location. Before this building was here, there was a church that was here, right? It was a Catholic church that served the university. The Catholic community here supported Muslim communities amazingly, you know? We likely wouldn't have an Islamic center if it wasn't for a Catholic priest that ran the church here, who was a great mentor of mine. And when the university bought this land, the Catholic Center is still on the first floor. That's why it says Catholic Center NYU. It was a part of the deal when they built the building. But then they took it down, and then there was just a hole here for a long time, right? And then they built something back up, right? And that's how you construct an establishment of some kind. You're literally establishing something in that. But the ownership of the establishing, right? The person who is doing the action is you. You can do this individually, you can do it communally, but the prayer is not establishing itself. When we talked about standing in prayer over the last few weeks, right? We said one of the integrals of the prayer, when you're in prayer, one of the obligations, and if you weren't here for that or you forgot, it's okay, we're going to review it in a few weeks, but one of the obligatory acts of prayer is standing. People remember when we talked about this? And then we said, like, in the Hanafi school, you have to just recite something of the Quran in the obligatory acts, in the standing, right? So the word for standing in Arabic is qiyam. It's got the same letters as this, right? Do you know that word already, qiyam?
No, I was just thinking about the grand qiyam, and it totally makes sense now.
Grand qiyam, look at that, right? Do people come to the grand qiyam in Ramadan? Do we know what Sam's talking about when we were here overnight? Right, so one of the things that happens a lot in the calendar year, but also more so at certain times seasonally, is people pray into the night. And if you've ever heard the name Layla, for example, right? Layla means night. Qiyamul Layl means standing in the night, right? So qiyam means standing. Iqama, when you say iqima salah, iqama salah, it's like you're establishing the prayer, meaning you're like making the prayer stand. Does that make sense? And the way you want to think about it is in this same way, right? If you walk through New York City, which is not like other parts of the world, and every block there's like a tree, or, you know, maybe not, but you see like these little trees. It's crazy. In the park, you can see them like surrounded by concrete, and they're baby trees. Those baby trees are in a place where if this is like the tree, it's usually like strengthened by some kind of pole that it's tied to. Do you get what I'm saying? Have you ever seen that in New York City, right? The pole is what is helping to make the tree stand, right? It needs a support mechanism. What this is saying is make the prayer stand the way the pole makes the fledgling tree stand, right? Be in a place where you have consciousness of how it is that you give it that support vehicle, that support structure. Because the goal is to not just pray the prayer and check it off, like I prayed the prayer. The goal is to pray to God. And in the course of the establishing of the prayer, one can think about this in a lot of different ways. You establish a place of prayer, you establish like your kind of ritual washing, the wudu, you establish this and that. But you want to think about it in this way, right? And then if you're in a place where you're trying to relate to religion, Islam as a religion tells you often just reflect on the things that are around you. So when I'm walking down the street and I'm trying to figure out how am I going to explain this, and like literally in front of me, there's this like little tree, you know, it's got all kinds of signs on it that say, don't let your dog like pee on this thing, right? It's like a little baby tree, you know, your dog's going to kill it if it does that. Do you know what I mean? Don't feed the pigeons, because when you feed the pigeons, you're feeding the rats, right? Only in New York City, there's like literal signs like this everywhere. And all that they're doing is they're saying like, hey, we are establishing the tree. We've got this thing with its branches tied up because the wind could knock this thing down. Rain's really bad, it's gonna get uprooted. Do you get what I'm saying? The idea in utilizing this as a metaphor, there's like a picture of a tree there. I don't know where it came from, but try to think about this, that if that tree had nothing in it, and you were to seek to push it down, the way that you might have ever seen a TV show before, where somebody in a comical fashion, they're trying to like hang up something and they take a hammer and it just goes straight through the wall, right? Because there's nothing behind that wall. They don't know necessarily, but it wasn't built in that way. It didn't necessitate that. Versus like a solid trunk that's got everything in it, if you tried to push through something that was hollow, you would break through it. But if you tried to push through something that was concrete, you'd probably break your hand banging against like a solid tree trunk. Do you know what I'm saying? That's what this is saying. Make it like solid. Help it to stand upright. Establish it in that way. The way that when you're standing, you're gonna make this thing stand in that capacity. Does that make sense? Right? And it's coming in this form to be able to say to you, like, nobody can do that for you because you don't pray my prayer. I don't pray your prayer. Islam as a religion does not have this established kind of hierarchy to authority. It's a very pure monotheism. It's you and God. There's nothing that you need between you and God. If you convert to Islam, you can literally take your shahada sitting in your home all alone, and nobody can tell you that you didn't become Muslim. Because you don't need a person to sanctify it. There's no kind of like person or individual that needs to bless in that way, shape, or form. There's certain things that can happen communally that then necessitate an individual leading a prayer or something to that extent, but it's not the same as what you would find in other religious traditions. Do you get what I mean? Like, I used to be a chaplain for the NYPD, and they have ceremonies of all kinds, like for everything, you know? And as chaplains, we were on a rotation because there was always an invocation at the beginning of a ceremony and a benediction at the end of it. And one of the things that I got invited to early on was they were doing like a street name for somebody. And I came and I asked the people who were part of the ceremonial unit, what are we doing? And they were like, an invocation, benediction, and you have to do a blessing for the plaque that they're gonna put up. And I was like, how do you do that? And they were like, just bless it. And I was like, I just asked you how to, and you told me to do it by doing it, right? Like, one of us is not making sense here. Like, we don't have this in our religious tradition. Do you know? And I said, it's not like, I'm not knocking somebody else's belief, but there's not something like this in what we do. And it trickles into this idea of like, there are religious scholars in Islam, there are individuals who study Islam, but it doesn't become the base of being like a mediator between you and God. You get what I mean? Why is that important? Because this is an individual obligation in Islam, right? I'm gonna give you like some terms in Arabic, but they're gonna be overarching categories of things. And so what salah fits into is not just an obligation, but it's an obligation, a fard, right? People remember the word fard, obligation. It's called a fard ayn. It's an individual obligation. This is different from a fard that's called a fard kifaya. Which is communal obligation. So, for example, somebody passes away in the community. That person has a right to, as the deceased, for their body to be washed and shrouded and prayed over and buried. As long as one of us knows how to do that, the entire responsibility towards that person is lifted. Not just knows, but does it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it has to get done, right? I had another funny story pop in my head, but it has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Maybe we'll tell you at the end. And if nobody knows how to do it, then the entire community is responsible and bears the burden of that obligation not being fulfilled, right? So you, for example, could fit social services under this, right? If you have capacity to build a shelter for survivors of abuse, you have capacity to set up food pantries and clinics, right? There's certain gaps, the underserved and underprivileged needs are not being met, right? They're communal responsibilities that need to happen. Does it mean everybody has to do it? No, but some people have to get it done. And if nobody's getting it done and there's capacity to, then that's a problem, you see? We're talking about individual obligations, the fardul ayn, that your prayer is your prayer. That's what salah fits under. You have to pray your fajr. I can't pray it for you as much as you can't pray it for me. I could do the janazah prayer, the funeral prayer for everybody in the room, right? Some of you might be able to do mine because you know how to do it, you know? But it doesn't mean all of us have to know how to do it. Just one of us needs to do it. But you can't do something that you don't know how to do. And in some acts, like, you're the only one that can do that thing. And salah, that's one of them. I want to share like some narrations that echo the importance of this, as we're going to get into it at a deeper level over the coming weeks. The mechanics, the do's and don'ts. We talked about the obligatory actions, the necessary actions, the recommended acts. We haven't talked about what nullifies the prayer, like what are disliked acts in the prayer, you know, and these kinds of things. We'll get into those as well. But here, we want to know, for example, like some of the kind of importance of this. There is a prophetic tradition where the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he says to his companions, Buni al-Islam ala khams, that Islam is built on things, on five things, right? And in Arabic, when you say building, it's binaya. So Buni al-Islam is that like you're literally building on these five things. And in normative Sunni practice of Islam, these are referred to like the five pillars of Islam, right? One, to say the Shahada, that you testify that there is nothing worthy of worship except God alone, and that Muhammad is his messenger. And then in this particular narration, it says the establishment of the prayer, the giving of the obligatory charity, the zakat, which we'll probably talk about towards the end of the year. Then it says the pilgrimage to God's house, Hajj al-Bayt, it says, right? The pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj. And then it says the fast of Ramadan. And those are the five things that are obligatory in terms of like ritual and practice across the board. For Muslims who are sane and post-pubescent, and then they get nuanced in terms of which ones are applicable to some but not others, right? Like everybody has to pray. Some people, they won't go for Hajj because they don't have the means to go for it, right? Some people, they won't give zakat because they don't have the wealth that requires them to. Some people, they're not going to fast in Ramadan because they don't have the physical capacity to fast. My father, who had a severe stroke some years ago, that left him paralyzed on the right side of his body and without the ability to speak, he still prays. The prayer changes a bit for him because of his physical restrictions, but the narrations say that even if you were to just pray with moving your eyes in the ways that your body would normally go, right? But prayer in this form is not something that is undermined. It's not a choice also. There's another narration that says, بَيْنَ الْمَرْءِ وَكُفْرِ تَرْكُ الصَّلَاةِ, that between an individual and disbelief, meaning like leaving Islam, is the abandonment of salah. What most people would say is that this is a qualitative understanding, that it's not an essential understanding. But we're gonna learn like prayer and mechanics according to one legal school of thought in Islam, in Sunni Islam, called the Hanafi school. There's another school that's called the Hanbali school. And the namesake of that school was a great scholar by the name of Ahmad ibn Hanbal. And he was of the opinion that said, no, if you don't pray, it is an essential distinction between somebody who's Muslim and somebody who's not. Not a qualitative distinction. And there were opinions that said if somebody wasn't praying, then that meant that they were outside of the fold of Islam. Most people would say no, like that's not the case. But I'm saying this to give you an understanding of what the importance is of it as an act in Islam and why it's also an important act, because it's an obligation and these are things that are owed to God, but the benefit comes to us back. So if you meet somebody as you are exploring Islam, somebody who might have a tangential relationship with their faith, right? A lot of us don't grow up necessarily learning so much. I didn't pray for a good chunk of like my adolescence and teens. I just left it behind and I forgot how to pray for the most part and had to reteach it to myself. Then when I started to explore religion and spirituality, when I was about 16 years old, I started looking at more different things. And I would, as I got older, I was 17, I would cut class and go to the mosque. And I just didn't know what to do. And I was very intimidated asking people, you know, for advice or anything like that. But where I'm at now is not where I was, but I'm also a product of where I came from. Do you get what I mean? And so I didn't have that sense of a connection, so to speak, because I didn't learn it in that way. I learned it only as like do's and don'ts. And it wasn't necessarily taught to me in Sunday schools. I went to like 12 different Sunday schools. It's terrible, you know? And fundamentally, like it didn't like click because it was just given in terms of lists. It's much harder to do this if it just becomes an ends and not a means to something. And you're not recognizing it for what it's intended to be and then thinking out, well, how do I establish it in that meaningful way that allows for me to sever connection to other things and then just focus on this connection in this way. The gain that's there, another prophetic tradition, the Prophet, peace be upon him, he asks his companions, like, what would you say of an individual who essentially like bathed themselves in a river flowing in front of their home 5 times a day? Like, how would you understand the state of this person to be? And they're gonna say, like, yeah, like, he's gonna be clean. Like, it's not dirt. You know what I'm saying? And the Prophet said, this is what your relationship is to the salah. Like, it's a cleansing mechanism. But the cleansing mechanism is not only outward. Because think about it. There's aspects that are about physical cleanliness also, right? You can't pray if you don't make wudu. You can't pray if there's filthy things on your body, right? You haven't like kind of washed off like urine or excrement. Somebody drops alcohol on you, these kinds of things. Like those are not clothes you can be praying in. So there's a physical aspect to the cleanliness also, because anticipating that I'm gonna pray is just gonna create better hygiene in relation to the prayer regarding like other things otherwise, but also it's like a metaphysical cleansing, right? It's an inward cleansing that becomes a protection. The way that when we fast, and we talked about it, that it yields consciousness, what the Quran says is that establish prayer, because the establishment of the prayer is a protection from things that are kind of corrupt and wicked and evil. That's what the yield is supposed to be, right? It shields you from doing like terrible things or problematic things. And are there terrible things that happen in the world? Yeah, like I was talking to my wife, you know, it's a long weekend. And I said to her like 2 weeks ago, hey, what should we do this coming weekend? You know, a long weekend coming up. And she was like, oh, you know, let's just kind of stay home. I was like, why don't we find some of our friends to hang out with? She's like, no, fine. And then yesterday she was like, why don't we hang out with some people this weekend? And I was like, oh, what a great idea. I wish I had said that 3 weeks ago. And I was sending names to her, like, you know, why don't we talk to hang out with this person, that person? And one, it's like crazy just what some people do with their lives, right? And one person I said, she was like, yeah, you know, they have kids also our age, and like we're close in age to the husband and wife too. And she said the wife isn't here this weekend because she's gone down to the Texas border to help protect asylum seekers. And she's gone with a lot of her own law students who themselves are undocumented or DACA recipients, and they can't cross the border because of that reason, but they're in a place where, you know, they want to help whatever they can, right? And it's like, wow, like there's people who are built that way, you know? Any one of those kids, let alone the professor who's our friend, they could step just like in the wrong place and someone will just send them out of the country. You know what I'm saying? But juxtaposing it now to the people who are willfully planning to make life difficult for asylum seekers. People who like will deliberately sit and plan about, let's get these size cages to put children in them when we separate them from their families at the borders. Like, that's a literal conversation that someone has. Do you get what I mean? They don't have just like in a giant warehouse a bunch of cages. Someone had to sit and plan and say, when they come, what should we do? And someone had to say, why don't we stick them in cages? And then someone had to go through the process of actually taking the step to buy and assemble and line up and lock the door behind people. How can you do that every step of the way? Do you get what I mean? Right? And what the Quran is saying, if you do this thing right, and it's going to be transformative inwardly, you're not gonna be in a place where you fall into that kind of mess. It's going to be a mechanism for inward transformation and healing. Cleanliness is going to serve as an agent of polishing your inside in a meaningful way. Does that make sense? Yeah. What I want you to do is just turn to the persons next to you a couple minutes. What are you taking away from this so far? And then we'll come back and discuss. Go ahead. Okay, so what are some of the things we're taking away from today?
It's cool, big mistakes. You know, like, yeah.
What are some of the things? Anything?
Nothing.
Yeah.
We were discussing a little bit about how the salah is kind of, not kind of, it is stated as a necessity in Islam, and our metaphor was kind of like drinking water, like we have to drink water to stay hydrated, but also to clean, you know, kind of impurities in our body, and maybe salah is something like that. It's
yeah.
Something that you need to do a certain amount of time a day, and just kind of gets rid of.
And it's amazing, like, analogy, right? When you drink a lot of water, it's not only kind of fleshing things out, but it's just giving you energy, right? It, like, literally, it's gonna make your skin brighter, right? Like, you're not gonna have all the kind of challenges you have. And you think about the alternatives that you turn to. People overdo, like, caffeine, coffee, all kinds of stuff. It's just killing their insides, you know? And that's what you can see with like your salah. If you do it and you do it consistently with like the regularity that you're supposed to, the yield is going to be positive as well as pushing out what's detrimental. But if you turn to other modes of engagement, it's just not going to give you like what it's intended to. Yeah. Other thoughts, other takeaways? Yeah.
It resonates when you describe it as a form of protection. And then back to this thought that it's an establishment, like providing a root or a foundation. So I think of the people who, as you mentioned, sort of go through these intentional processes to create cages for children. And I would assume or come to the conclusion that maybe that they're not, I don't mean to put it like this, but they're sort of like lost in the wind, or they're just, they don't really, maybe don't have a sense of ground and morality. So if that's the energy around them, they're just kind of going with it. Versus having a reference point or their own foundation where even if there's chaos around them or evil around them, they have nothing to sort of root themselves in.
Yeah, and Islam is like a religion that sees prayer as an anchoring force. You know, it's a mechanism for grounding. When it's done with that like inward and outward aspect understood, and it's not just then like the shell of it or the mechanics of it, but you're simultaneously utilizing your body as a means to connect to God through your heart, right? And that connection, that silla that we're talking about, it's not like a bodily connection. Do you know what I mean? Because we have an essential understanding of God that is different from other religious traditions. And so there's no anthropomorphizing of God in Islam in any way. So there's not like a literal connection taking place on a physical sense, but the part of you that if you were to think about yourself on a whole, that you're connecting now through Salah to God, like what's that connection being made through? Do you know what I mean? And what's like the driving part of you in formulating that connection? And a lot of times we make decisions through our stomachs, we make decisions through our sexual organs, we make decisions through like externals, we make decisions through all different things. Fundamentally, the prayer in all of its postures has your entire physical body oriented in a certain capacity, but the idea is that the driving force is your heart, right? That's what it is that you want to be sovereign in the midst of this, and then it enables you to have that presence outside of the prayer as well. In Islamic tradition, the mandate for five daily prayers, we talked about like some weeks ago when we first started talking about prayer, but the catalyst for it wasn't something that we discussed, right? So if you remember, for those who are here, the mandate of five daily prayers comes to the Prophet Muhammad when he goes on a journey from his home to the city of Jerusalem and ascends into the heavens. And there's a conversation that we discussed where Moses, peace be upon him, like asks him, what did you speak to God when he enters into this level of heaven? And he says, you know, God told me to pray 50 times a day for my community. And Musa alayhi salam, Moses, peace be upon him, says to the Prophet Muhammad alayhi salam, peace be upon him, like, go back, your people are not going to do 50. Mine didn't do what they were supposed to do. Yours are definitely not going to do what they're supposed to do. They go back and forth in this way until it comes down to five. Do people remember when we talked about this? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Do you just nod your head to make me feel good? Yeah? You remember? Great. Yeah. What's happening before this, when Islam is revealed and the first revelation comes to the Prophet Muhammad, he thinks he's lost his mind. He's seeking solitude in a cave known as the Cave of Hira, the top of a mountain. The angel Gabriel is a very important entity within Islamic tradition, similar to other religious traditions. He comes with this initial revelation, and what the narrations and the tradition say is that everywhere the Prophet looked in the horizon, he just saw the angel, a really massive creature. When he goes home, he is shivering out of shock. He doesn't know what's happening, and his wife Khadija, radiallahu ta'ala anha, may God be pleased with her, puts a blanket on the Prophet's shoulders. He like says everything he has to, and she gives him affirmation. You're a good man. You treat orphans with dignity, and you remember the world's forgotten. You honor rights of guests. You wouldn't be tested in this way, you know? And then she's with him throughout all of it. She's supportive of him, like has his back through everything. There's a really deep love that's there, right? When the Prophet describes the love that he has and the love he receives for his wife Khadija, the Arabic word he uses is a derivation of rizq, which is your sustenance, right? But he's saying like her love was something that God like instilled within me and gave to me, but it was a source of sustenance, he's saying, right? She passes away. And when she passes away, they say he's not the same person as he was prior to her passing. Like years later, to give you an idea, there's an instance where a necklace that belonged to his wife by chance came into his hand, and tears just started pouring out of his face
because it was a reminder of this person that he loved so much. Not only did she die that year, but his uncle Abu Talib also passed away, and he was an elder in this very tribalistic Meccan society, right? So when you think about Mecca, just on a sociological level, there's like no mayor of Mecca. There's no governor of Mecca. The city itself is not ruled by policies and these kinds of things, but it's broken into clans. And the way a clan is kind of given strength is through how it protects its kind of most underprivileged members. You know, there's kind of a connection, right? So you all could be like one clan, and the most elite and powerful amongst you had the responsibility of caring for the ones that were most underserved and underprivileged. And that's what the Meccan society was like. And the stronger clans were the ones that had more nobility, the more powerful ones that had like certain lineage. And the Prophet came from a clan that was called the Quraysh. And they were given a certain dignity because, amongst other things, they were the caretakers of the Kaaba in Mecca. The black cube, if you've ever seen it, when people are going for pilgrimage to Mecca. And Abu Talib was the Prophet's uncle. And because he was alive and he was an elder with like noble kind of status, nobody could do anything to his nephew. They could do things to his followers and to other people, but they couldn't do anything to him because he had the protection of his uncle. And then his uncle passes away too. And both of these things happen in the same year. There's a genre of literature in our tradition that's called the Sirah. And this is in reference to the prophetic biography, right? It's like the Prophet's life. You should read like some of these books. There's one by a person named Martin Lings that's pretty popular. And so in the Sirah literature, this year that the Prophet's wife and his uncle pass away is called Am al-Huzn, the year of sadness, the year of depression, the year of grief. He's like really in a down state. These two people he loves so much have passed away, and they passed away in the same year. And so what happens when this takes place is, after that, he goes through this difficult experience of just inward angst, right? And there's more stuff that we could talk about, and in interest of time we won't. But in the aftermath of that is when he's taken on this journey. And he's given this thing of prayer as a mechanism also for like inward healing. Do you know what I mean? You think about the person you love more than anybody in the world. Think about who you love like so deeply, right? I love my daughter Medina so much. I didn't know what love was until we had my daughter. And some of you heard me say this before, I literally loved her so much. When my wife was pregnant with our son, I said to my wife, I don't think I'm going to like him so much. And she said, what? You can't, like, don't talk about our child like that. And I said, I wasn't being facetious. I just couldn't fathom how I could love somebody as much as I loved our baby girl. And then when Kareem was born, not only did the love I have for his sister not diminish, it increased. I had just as much love for him, and the two of them just helped me fall more in love with their mother every day. I can't imagine what it would feel like to lose any one of them, let alone losing more than one of them, and all within a short time span. Like what it would do to me. And that's what happened to the Prophet. And then God, who's watching over the Prophet, could give him anything. When he brings him to the heavens as a mechanism for his healing, he gives him the 5 daily prayers. Just like any kind of prescription, you could turn something into a vice rather than it being a virtue or source of healing. You get what I mean?
But the intended purpose of this act is what it is, and in order for it to yield it, that's where the establishment of it has to be something that resonates, right? You have to be the one that, as you explore this religion, you're a new convert to it, you were born into it and trying to rebuild a relationship to it. When you walk past the tree on the sidewalk, that's branches are all tied up with strings, and there's this giant pole that's holding it up. That's what it's doing. It's helping the tree to stand. It's establishing it. That's what it means to establish the prayer. You're helping it to be stood upright. Do you get what I'm saying? What we're going to start to use is a text that's called Ascent to Felicity. It's a Hanafi fiqh-like manual. It's got some aspects of theology in it. If you can't buy the book, which you don't have to, you can find excerpts of it online. If you Google Hanafi fiqh books, you know, it'll come up on like archive.com and stuff. But try to support, you know, where you can if you have the money. We're going to be looking at the prayer sections as we go through the mechanics of the prayer. The other thing that we'll do when we start that next week, we're going to talk about a concept also that is called khushu', that is like focus in the prayer, concentration in the prayer, how to build that, right? And so what I'd like to do is use half of the class to go through like the outward mechanics, as well as half of the class to talk about inwards, relatively speaking, and then end like around this time, so that for people who need to find a place to pray, the building's gonna close at 8, so we won't be able to pray our sunset prayer here. You'll have adequate time to get either to like a nearby mosque, or you could wash up and pray in the park or in front of the, you know, there's a big open space in front of our business school down the street, or like a more quiet park, like right behind this building. It's called Suzuki Garden. There's hardly anybody ever there. It used to be like my quiet place, and then COVID happened and I didn't have a place to feed people indoors. And so I made the mistake of showing people my secret place. And now they do lots of things there. But you can pray there if you want. It's a really nice, quiet place. But if you want to look for this text, you can just also Google this with PDF attached to it. And then one of the things on archive.com, they'll show you like 8 or 9 different Hanafi fiqh books. The second one is Ascent to Felicity. That's the one. You can buy it on Amazon.com as well. If you want to buy a copy but you don't have the funds, let me know. We can help to get that. But we'll start to go through it. It'd be great if people who aren't are bringing some kind of like recording tools, notebook, paper, just so it becomes a little bit more concrete, right? Statistically, when you write something down, you're going to remember it like 60 to 70% more than if you're just trying to like absorb information, you know? And we're going to like do it a little differently than what I was doing in the prayer room where we were writing on the whiteboard, but we'll kind of delineate a little bit more because I realize my handwriting is terrible, and have some PowerPoints that kind of show you how these things are more categorized, as well as give like some of the basis of where does it come from. You know, so that we're a little bit more connected to kind of the particular postures and movements and kind of invocations in the course of the prayer itself. Yeah, great. So we'll see everybody next week. Thank you so much.